Welcome to The Lives They're Living. It's a podcast about people who have done amazing things and who at this point in their life are flying a little bit more under the radar than they really deserve to be. I'm your host, Ben Yagoda. Each week we bring on a guest who can provide expert testimony on the person at hand. My guest for this episode is Gene Seymour, and the subject is the novelist, essayist, musician, and provocateur Ishmael Reed. Gene Seymour started his career as a reporter at the Hartford Courant in his native Connecticut, moved on to the Philadelphia Daily News, where he says he found his estimable voice, then went on to Newsday, where for 18 years he was a film critic and jazz columnist. In 1995, he published a young adult history, Jazz, the Great American Art. These days, he lives in Philadelphia, contributes mightily on a remarkable range of subjects from baseball to crime novels and many steps in between to The Nation, Book Forum, CNN.com, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and others. Gene Seymour, welcome to The Lives They're Living.
Good to be here.
Yeah, let me start off with a coincidence. I just learned that he turned 86 on February 22nd, which is not only my birthday, but George Washington's birthday.
That's right.
I have to think that Reed has somewhere made something of the Washington connection, as steeped as he is in American history.
He's very much into numerology. To his credit, he doesn't come to any definite conclusions on the significance. He just says, isn't that weird? Isn't that interesting? Let's exult in the weirdness, and let's move from there. So,
I like that. I like that. I mean, I just read something, rather cutting remarks that he made about George Washington. He's got this recent thing about Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Miranda's Hamilton, yes. He's at war with that, and he has made, he continues every time the subject comes up. I mean, it doesn't even have to come up. He just brings it up. And he's been excoriated in places like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as some kind of spoil sport, you know, a rainer on parades, if there's such a thing as this.
It started out with, he had an essay called Hamilton and the Negro Whispers, Miranda's Consumer Fraud, then another essay, Hamilton, the musical, Black actors dress up like slave traders, and it's not Halloween. And then he wrote a play, The Hunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda, which was a Christmas carol-like drama where Miranda is visited by the ghosts of Hamilton.
Yeah.
He's still picking fights.
Well, he has always believed that there has existed in African American letters a tradition of combativeness. You know, Frederick Douglass is viewed as somebody who engages with the enemy, the white supremacist enemy, using their weapons of language and rhetoric and all that stuff. Reed has always broken it down to the essentials of writing is fighting, which is the title of one of his collections of essays, and which he borrowed from Muhammad Ali, that great American poet, and I think pugilist too. He always feels compelled to pick a fight, and yet, oddly enough, I don't know if the fighting really revolves around any single ideological point. I think he really mixes it up to kind of stir the pot and raise controversy for the sake of simply saying everything you know is wrong, period. You know, and I'm not saying I'm always right, but you're wrong. I'm going to tell you why you're wrong. Some people have said, you know, because he does have such a strong footing among American satirists, they tended to sort of regard this as being part of his shtick. And I think it's more than that. But even if it weren't, so what? Because as you're well aware, I think shtick is one of the great American products of American culture. And if it is part of a shtick, it's fine. I don't think he's acting, though. I think, you know, there's always an implication that when you do shtick, you're just performing,
yep,
just to get a rise. I think that there is a level of seriousness between merely having his wicked fun at others' expense. I think there is something serious that he's saying that revolves around the idea that no one in America has the right to understand minority cultures too quickly, or to put them in too easy boxes. And I think that when he goes after something like Hamilton, part of his impulse is like, I don't agree with him on what he says about Hamilton. I happen to like Hamilton, but I think that what he's trying to say is, don't put us into any boxes and keep us there, because you don't know everything. Lin-Manuel doesn't know everything, and even I don't know everything. So I think that is the method to his madness, I think.
Well, let's back up a little bit. And can you tell me when Ishmael Reed first came on your radar?
Well, in the 60s, I was reading, I was the archetypical black bookworm when I was in high school, and I was, groping, grasping for any confirmation that black people wrote, and particularly contemporary black people wrote. And fortunately, I was in high school at a time, the late 60s, when there was a publishing boom going on. There were these emergent black voices coming in. I think, though, that I was looking for something that didn't necessarily fall in line with what was viewed as the prevailing strain of what was then contemporary black writing, and that was advocacy in terms of the civil rights movement, black nationalism, a kind of a strictly observed black nationalism, where if you deviated at all from what was perceived to be black, you were somehow on the verge of becoming a race traitor of some kind, that if you dared think outside the box, you were suspect. And I wanted as many possibilities at my disposal as possible. I was seeking people who did work, actively work outside the box, and found ways of making that black voice definitive and hard and recognizably black, but also open to as many possibilities for framing their stories, my stories, other people's stories, as much as possible. When I came across Reed, my first book of his that I read was his second novel, which was Yellowback Radio Broke Down, which was a Western spoof. And I happened to be enraptured with Western spoofs. This was before Blazing Saddles, but there were other. It was in the air, people poking holes in the Western ethos that I and many of my contemporaries grew up with. But it was like reading somebody who was not just spoofing, but creating and inventing, almost on the spot, a kind of black satire of African American comedy that was very much in the tradition of people like William S. Burroughs and Mad Magazine. The first person that I had thought of, believe it or not, was Nathaniel West.
Well, I was just about to say that because he has cited Nathaniel West.
Yes.
I mean, Dante,
Yeah.
Nathaniel West. I mean, Hollywood movies are all over the place. He has a
Right.
poem called Life is a Screwball Comedy,
Comedy, yeah.
jazz,
Yeah.
the
All the
dozens,
things, all the things
everything.
that I loved, that I was being influenced on, I was seeing and holding in my hands as a book. And to me, this was tremendously liberating, and offered many, many possibilities. I think the main thing that I had drawn from him, and that I continued to draw from him over the decades, is the way he widened the space for a certain kind of expression, where everything was fair game. I mean, he was bringing all this stuff up that, I'd only vaguely heard about. Certainly, I didn't hear about it in school. I didn't even know there was such a thing as Yoruba culture, and certainly not, even the only hoodoo and voodoo I'd seen were in all those Val Lewton horror movies of the 40s. I had no knowledge of that there was a real cultural dynamic, but he was opening those doors for me, and he was leading me to other people who could tell me more about them. And I would not have found Robert Ferris Thompson, who was this anthropologist who was very much into those African traditions and made connections of those traditions, those African traditions, if I hadn't read Mumbo Jumbo or any of the other things that Reed had written in those years. So just opening that space.
Well, let's tell a little bit about his life story. I believe he was born in Tennessee, but
Right.
family moved up to Buffalo when he was young and grew up there.
Yeah. He was born in Chattanooga, and he's very proud of his Tennessee roots. He named his daughter Tennessee, but they moved to Buffalo, New York. I was reading the Paris Review interview he did just a few years ago, where he talks about going to school in those years. Like most of us, there were so many things that we weren't taught and weren't exposed to that we had to sort of guess at. That's another thing that I identified with him, because I think most of the discoveries that I made in literature and culture were sort of off the tracks, were off the reservation, if you will. And he had the same haphazard encounters that I did with poetry, with Black poetry, and with writers like, as we say, Nathaniel West and others who he sort of picked up along the way and found common ground with the way he saw the world, with the way they saw the world. And he wanted all of that opened up. Jazz was tremendously important to him, not just jazz as musical background, but jazz as an impulse, as a way of being, as a way of sort of taking whatever you found and just creating your own or spinning off your own ideas and your own narrative off whatever fragments you picked up on the ground or found in the air. You just sort of created that. And there was a tremendous release that he got from that. He talks about the time he went off to Europe. He went to Paris as part of some church fellowship or something. And he discovered things like existentialism. He met real African people, and he came to the conclusion that many of us did, that what they were teaching us in school was a lie. It made him think, as it made other people of my generation and his generation think, maybe all of it or most of it is misleading.
He didn't have a huge amount of formal education. He went to University of New York at Buffalo for a while. I don't think he finished, but he
No.
soaked up so much, whether it was jazz or art or poetry, philosophy, movies. And the term he uses is the gumbo approach.
That's right. The writers that you're drawn to, I guess this is true for you too, but the writers you're drawn to become important when they articulate something that you always knew you knew, but didn't know until somebody else said it,
Right.
and you say, okay, then I'm not crazy. Somebody else knows this as well. Again, this is true of most people with the encounters they have with music and culture and whatever, with art. But whenever somebody speaks that secret thing inside of you're theirs for life, no matter what they say or what they do in the coming years.
Well, you were on it early, but the book that really put him on the map, I think I first became aware of his name was Mumbo Jumbo, the novel, 1972, and Harold Bloom, no less, has named it one of the 500 great books of the Western canon, and it's outrageous. It's to use a word that your Uncle Chuck Stone, I'm now remembering favorites, audacious.
That's right.
I mean,
That's right.
it starts off, there's no front matter, there's no
No.
copyright, it's just number one, the number one, and then a true sport, the mayor of New Orleans, and capitalization is all over the map. Spiffy in his patent leather, brown and white shoes, his plaid suit, the Rudolph Valentino parted down the middle hairstyle, sits in his office, sprawled upon his knees, is Zuzu, local doo-wackadoo and voodoo-do fizz gig, a slatternly floozy, her green sequin dress quivers. I mean, come on, that's
No, well,
what an opening.
It's one of those books that counts off, doesn't so much start, but counts off the way an
Yeah.
old jazz record does.
Right.
And exactly that way, because all of a sudden it's like, wait, whoa, where are we going here? But you just, as with a jazz record, you just have to either move with it or move away from it. And again, I had encountered some of those impulses with the Beats, you know, Ginsberg and Burroughs, and of course Kerouac. And he also has said that he got a lot of inspiration from the Beat movement. But to see somebody like him who consciously and deliberately fashions a style, an opening that opens the way, you know, a jazz combo does, just jumping literally right into it. And you just want to know, well, where's he going with this?
He's got, the gumbo thing. He's got photographs, drawings, all sorts of elements thrown in, whatever goes in the soup. And this is before W.G. Sebald, who was famous for putting
That's right.
photographs in his book. He's got poetry in there. He's before ragtime, but he's got real figures like
That's right.
Warren G. Harding and Irene Castle and whatnot.
And it didn't matter whether you could somehow pull it all together. I've read the book four or five times at least, and I find something new all the time, which is what you're supposed to do when you have a great book. But the first time I read it, you know, things kind of glanced across my head like, wait, Warren G. Harding was black? Or, you know, all these other kinds of things. And when something like that hits you at first, and you realize he's kidding, but he's not kidding. And that makes you wonder about everything else he throws in there, whether it's the ideas, whether it's the whole notion of just grew.
That's this sort of thing that unites the novel. It
Right.
just grew, and sometimes it's a virus, which is at a weirdly prescient reading it in the COVID days, but other times it's this sort of spirit of funk and jazz.
The life force. It's a life force.
Yeah.
And again, I guess it was my third reading that I realized that it wasn't one or the other. It's both in the ways that other things that we think are afflicting us are also, in a weird way, helping us and inoculating us from other things that we didn't know were harmful, but may have been harming us all along. And whether it's white supremacy, whether it's cultural stultification, whether it's censorship or any of these things that society uses to keep people in line. I even taught the book once, and I basically said to them, go with it. Just go with all of this. Don't worry about how it connects, because really, you're not so much reading a story. You're throwing yourself into somebody's vision. You're throwing somebody right in the middle of a party, you know, and you've got to kind of sort your way out with all these different things happening in the room with you. He was trying to say that we don't have to feel oppressed or insulted. We can take these things, turn them around, and use them, you know, to push ahead. We can take all these things that the slave masters give us and put them on ourselves and say, okay, this is what you gave us. What do you think? You know, and turn it around like that. And that's still an impulse in African American art and particularly in literature that people don't know what to do with. Anyway, Mumbo Jumbo, you're right. That is the signature work and the place that to begin.
I mean,
Yeah.
also reading it, it reminded me a bit of some of these so-called postmodernists like Pynchon
Yes.
and John Barth, who just passed away, Robert Coover, a lot of
Yep.
these other people in that late 60s, early to mid 70s era were being really playful, Barthelme, and messing around in kind of a similar way as he
Yeah.
was doing.
I always tell people when I read those books now, people those things reviewed as surrealist as opposed to realist. But sometimes I tell people, if you look at the way the world is now in the 21st century, They feel a lot more realistic somehow than they did,
Yes, they really do. There's a quote, I don't know if you're aware of it, from Pynchon's 1973 novel, Gravity's Rainbow,
I
the
am.
famous book that I've never
Yes.
read. One of the characters says, "Keep in mind where those Masonic mysteries came from in the first place. Check
Yep.
out Ishmael
I'll
Reed. He
read.
knows
Yep.
more about it than you will ever find here."
I did encounter that. I'm trying to think. I made three attempts at reading that whole book before I finally did read the whole thing. And I got as far as that. I said, whoa. And I thought, okay, well, there's a lattice of coincidence, as they say in Repo Man, of these sensibilities sort of joining each other.
Thomas Pynchon and Reed, very close in age. Pynchon's born in 1937, Reed in 1938. They're both in New York City in the late 50s, very early 60s. And Reed helped found the East Village Other.
It's really weird when you see all this stuff that's coming out now about the Village Voice, these new books, and how the Voice was this alternative paper. You forget that there were alternatives to the alternative in those years, and people like Ishmael Reed were one of them. And one of the reasons why is that the Village Voice didn't have any minority writing of any kind, and the East Village Other was a place where that where those gaps could be filled, where those voids could be inhabited. And a lot of it, of course, was his poetry too. He was His reputation as a poet was growing. This book, Conjure, which was one of the first books of poetry that I read of his, and I actually bought it because of one poem in particular that somehow found its way into one of the Norton anthologies that was taught at my college, and it was called "Beware, Do Not Read This Poem." You're familiar with that, right? About
I have a factoid about it. It was cited, passive voice, so I don't know by whom, one of approximately 20 poems that teachers and librarians have ranked as the most frequently studied in literature
That's
courses.
right.
I mean, he's done so much. So novels, multiple novels. Probably his second most famous novel is Flight to Canada.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that one.
Much like Mumbo Jumbo, is an historical burlesque. I think this is the first one of that doesn't include the presence of what he calls his psychic detective, Papa Labasse. I always imagine him, look, we mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois earlier. I always imagine Papa Labasse being this kind of Du Boisian figure with a goatee and a full suit, looking very scholarly and poised, and walking around with this mysterious cane that has these magical properties. Flight to Canada is something entirely different. And when I say it's a burlesque, it delves into slavery without any need to be faithful to historical record or decorum. There are so many anachronisms, deliberate anachronisms in this book about slavery. There's television coverage of somebody doing a tightrope walk across Niagara Falls. There's all this other stuff. There's a portrait of Lincoln, which talks about, among other things, what a high-pitched voice Lincoln had spoken in. Reed's not known for characterizations. He, in fact, he, I get the feeling he doesn't really like to spend too much time with developing true character, depth of character. But his portrait of Lincoln and the self-doubts that Lincoln has and the way he questions himself about the Negro, as he calls it, he has a way of bringing stuff out about Lincoln that, wait, really? We didn't know any of this, because at that time, particularly in the mid-70s when this came out, you had one train of thought that still regarded Lincoln as a secular saint. And you had this other, more insurgent movement, particularly among Black historians, who insisted on saying he was not even close to a saint. He was really a racist. He hated us. He wanted to get rid of us. And once he freed us, it took him so long that if he loved us so much, why didn't he free us the first chance he got, et cetera, et cetera. Reed strikes what for him is a relatively temperate portrait between these two extremes. thus illuminating either case, but also making you see that there's something more complex going on with Lincoln and therefore with America that you may not have expected to think about when you started the book. And you may not even, want to think about because of the other aspects of the book that are openly, as I say, anachronistically funny or that have this kind of sketch comedy segment to it. But when I read this for the first time, I was just knocked out by it because I felt that whole landscapes of new thought, of fresh thought about antebellum life, about slavery, about even about Reconstruction, were just sort of opened up by this book. And it's interesting that it came out around the same time as Roots, which was, of course, the 800-pound gorilla in those years. I was working in a bookstore and we had so many copies of Roots in the store that we made chairs out of them that people could sit in, and they just flew out of the shelves. And I told people, you should read this too. And of course, nobody was interested. Nobody
You might have
cared.
made a small footstool out of Flight to
At
Cat, you know.
best, yeah, but I was passionately advocating this book to other people.
It, Flight to Canada also has this, again, bringing in these real life historical characters. Harriet Beecher Stowe
That's right.
is a major figure, and
That's right.
basically portrayed as a plagiarist. I'm not
Yep.
sure the truth of that, but Reed strikes me as rather a scholar, so I kind of tend to believe his take on things. He's
Well,
got
you all
footnotes and, of course, and
right.
all sorts of apparatus in there.
You may disagree with him, and I have my own disagreements with him on many things, but you can't deny after reading enough of his books that he may know something you don't. And as such, you should always keep cool before you come to any easy judgments. One of his recent causes, public tantrums, was over the movie Django Unchained. He is not a fan of Quentin Tarantino in general and of this particular slave rebellion movie in particular. He's called Tarantino a racist, and he said that Samuel L. Jackson's portrayal of the house Negro working in Leonardo DiCaprio's plantation means something like always play what you know or something nasty like that. It was
Ooh.
very mean, very mean. But I always thought that something that in Reed that chafed at the idea that somebody else's deliberately anachronistic slave pastiche was getting all this money and attention while his is still regarded as this kind of relatively neglected boutique item. And I on the book's behalf, I kind of share that. Even though I don't agree with him about Tarantino or Django, I understand where he's coming from on that.
Well, we're talking about his enemies. Reading his introduction to the Reed reader, the big group is the feminists,
Yes.
who seem to be upset with him, or he's upset with them over their depiction or characterization of black masculinity,
Black men, yeah,
Alice
black masculine.
Walker and the
Yes,
like.
that's right. That's
That
right.
seems to still be a thing for him.
Can I just tell you a story here? I was a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he was speaking. I think it was Community College of Philadelphia. He was invited to speak. He was there for a weekend of events. He was answering questions from the audience, and somebody asked him about Alice Walker. And I kind of knew what was coming. I look over at somebody else, and we're both kind of looking at each other. We're going, here it comes. And he goes into it, talks about Alice Walker, talks about Color Purple and how it demeans. It turns black men into monsters. And the audience was like shocked. They just assumed that black writers had nothing but salutary things to say about other black writers. And this through the whole afternoon, they wouldn't let it go. And he was not happy about it. I mean, I tried to get an interview with him afterwards, and he was not happy about the way things had turned, but I kind of said to him, come on, I mean, you had to have expected this.
Yeah, right.
You had to have known this was going to
I
happen.
mean, we all know people who've got axes to grind, and some of them it makes them bitter, people who just spend all their time resenting people. And fortunately for Reed, it seems to animate him. I
It
mean, it
animates
doesn't
him.
stop him. He's no less creative than he otherwise would have been.
Well, not only that, but he also is not as misogynist as people tend to label him. He's a very prolific editor and a prolific advocate of other writers. He's been very, very outspoken in his defense of Toni Morrison, of Paula Marshall, of I mean, Dostoevsky. He one of his many literary magazines published was the first to publish excerpts from what became For Colored Girls, you know, et cetera, et
Well,
cetera.
and he had a long career, very long career as a professor, 35 years at University of California, Berkeley, and Terry McMillan was one of his prized
Protege.
students.
You know, he's always had that. That same weekend, I saw him give out prizes to young writers at Temple. He was very gentle and very encouraging, took their questions and everything else. And again, but nobody wants to talk about that. They want to talk about his pugilistic side. And he knows how the game is played. He knows the ways of public renown and how capricious they are.
Let me ask you about another quote that he mentions in the introduction to the Reed Reader. He was at some gathering and he heard the words, "Ishmael Reed, you ain't nothing but a gangster and a con artist." And he turned and he saw it was said by none other than Ralph Ellison.
Yep, and there's been a weird relationship between those two over the years. One of his literary anthologies, Yardbird Reader, which he published, Yardbird Reader published an extensive Q&A with Ellison, you know, and this was at or around the time when Ellison's reputation was kind of in eclipse after the 60s. He was deemed, you know, not militant enough or anything more a tool of the literary establishment. Reed will also say that he had more in common with Ellison than Ellison ever really acknowledged, especially again in the idea of culture itself, the broadness of culture, the possibilities of culture, and of using those elements to create a kind of literature that had the same looseness and flow of jazz, of good jazz. Ellison, however, who made no secret of his disdain for bebop, and I think what he saw in Reed was a kind of a bebop element in Black literature that he did not approve of. The same relationship with Baldwin. I mean, Reed was an articulate defender of Baldwin's work, but he also has over the years his issues with Baldwin. There was one interview he did, and I've never forgotten this, where on the one hand he said, in the tradition of Judeo-Christian literature, James Baldwin is one of the greatest writers who ever lived. But then he goes on to say that in his public persona, he comes along like a hustler playing Job. I don't need to tell you how this literary gamesmanship works, where you try to jump on somebody to make your own reputation. What made Reed different, even in this aspect, was that he understood it was a game in ways that some of the people he antagonized didn't. He understood that it was just as important to assert the things that made those writers important to him. He never stopped loving Baldwin or expressing appreciation for Baldwin for help giving him the initiative and the inspiration to become everything he became, even though he became a very different writer from Baldwin. He said, "None of that's important as long as you write, as long as you do have something to say."
So we talked about the influence of jazz on him and this sort of jazz sensibility, which I think is completely true. But he also has been involved in creating music as a band leader, a lyricist, a pianist. He's done so many things.
He knows his stuff. I do, in fact, own an LP and CD, the album Conjure, on which he has such great artists as Alan Toussaint and David Murray setting his poetry to music. And the piano is very interesting. He started playing piano very late in life. Like, I think he said he started playing either in his 60s or 70s, just out of the blue, he decided he wanted to do that. And he's always doing things like that. He said he started learning Japanese at a very advanced age, and he even wrote a novel called Japanese by Spring, which, by the way, I think is one of his best novels. But he talks about the impulse to sort of learn new things and keep new things. There's even a poem in this new anthology of his, the most recent one, Why the Black Hole Sings the Blues, which is a great title, by the way. He has one poem in there about surviving all the things he's had done. He's talking to different parts of his body and expressing appreciation that you didn't give out on me when, and that you gave me enough time to learn the piano, to learn how to speak Yoruba, to learn all these new languages and ways of doing things. So, although he'd probably chafe at being called a role model, because he would probably think that's among the cornier aspects of Black inspirational life, the fact is he's kind of a role model for generations of writers, not just in the way he sort of exploded and broke down barriers to expression and opened up possibilities for fresh expression, but in just keeping one's wits sharp, keeping one's prospects open. And maybe, Ben, that's why he gets himself into a rage at certain things. This is how you know you're alive. This is how you keep from being dead inside. You go after Lin-Manuel Manuel to keep yourself.
The bigger they come, the harder they fall.
Exactly. Exactly.
A quote I think about a lot, and I know you're aware of it, and probably you think about it too, is F. Scott Fitzgerald, "There are no second acts in American lives." And I'm wondering, I mean, he seems to have been done a pretty good job of second act, a third act. He's like a Shakespearean five act. Is, do you think
He has.
so?
And I think one of the reasons why is that he has refused to let the vagaries of mainstream publishing get to him. When something's closed off, he'll invent his own avenue. He'll go to independent publishers, or failing that, he will create his own press, his own magazine, his own outlets. You're constantly finding out stuff about other people. Not just about him, but others. And I think that too, if you are willing to kind of feel the sting and lash of his aggression sometimes, you might find that that as you do with Mumbo Jumbo and Flight to Canada and his other works or his poetry, that you're taken to a place that you didn't expect to go, and you're encouraged to sort of make something out of it yourself. And I think that's one of the great things about his legacy, which despite everything continues into his 80s.
I'll throw out one more quote. He says about himself, "I'm a pretty good writer who has written day after day, year after year."
He does that. I heard him once ask, somebody had asked him that question. What's your daily routine? What are your habits? He said, I can write anywhere, anytime. He said, I'm in this hotel. I'm staying at this hotel right now. I just got up and I just started scribbling stuff down. I just do it. He just does the job. For him, it's enough for him to be in the world for inspiration. Agitation is inspiration for him. So picking a fight and seeing what happens when you make that first blow, that's inspiration. Getting hit is inspiration. That transaction, that process, is something that keeps him open to possibilities. Those of us who have tried to do that, we don't always meet the moment that aggressively. We sometimes shrink from it. Times like this, when I reconnect with his work, I think I got to work harder at leading with my chin once in a while.
Now here's your moment of Ishmael Reed.
This is called The Author Reflects on His 35th Birthday. 35, I've been looking forward to you for many years now, so much so that I feel you and I are old friends. And so on this day, 35, I propose a toast to me and you. 35, from this day on, I swear before the Venerable Cyrus that if I ever try to bring out the best in folks again, I want somebody to take me outside and kick me up and down a sidewalk, or sit me in a corner with a funnel on my head. Make me as hard as a rock, 35. Like the fellow in the story about the big one that got away. Let me laugh my head off with Moby Dick as we reminisce about them suckers who went down with the Pequod.